This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The band Nirvana reinvigorated rock in the 1990s. My guest Dave Grohl powered the band with his hard-driving drumming. In 1994, lead singer Kurt Cobain committed suicide and the band dissolved. The following year, Grohl re-emerged from behind the drum kit to center stage as the lead singer and songwriter of a new band, Foo Fighters. Last year, Esquire magazine named Grohl Best Entertainer and Foo Fighters drummer Taylor Hawkins as Best Drummer. Over the summer, the Foo Fighters released a 10th anniversary edition of their album, The Color and the Shape. Now they have a new CD called Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. Let's start with a track from it. This is The Pretender. The Foo Fighters from their new CD, Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. Dave Grohl, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Does this new CD represent a new direction for the band?
It does, yeah. We've been a band now for 13 years, and with this album, we've taken everything a little bit farther than we ever have. Lyrically and musically, this album is filled with string quartets and pianos and odd time signatures and low level dynamic and really huge rock songs, and I'm really proud of this one because I feel like we've managed to step it up to a whole new level.
You know, in a moment I want to play another track from your new CD, and this is called Let It Die, and I want to play this because it represents two ends of your singing and music. It starts off, you know, very acoustic, quiet, singing, and ends up loud, and your voice is kind of full throttle scream. Yeah. And before we actually hear that, I want to ask you a little bit about the full throttle scream style of vocal that you're capable of. What does that do to your voice?
Oh, it does horrible things to my voice. I don't even want to know what it's doing to my voice. I just kind of get out there and do it. There's a part of me that I feel really fortunate that I'm in a band that can have that polar opposite swing. You know, where we can begin a song that has a beautiful, delicate melody and an acoustic piece that's finger picking and beautiful, you know. And then by the end of the song, it's like helter skelter. It's just some screaming bloody murder, you know. It feels good to do that. I mean, it's there are two sides of my personality that most people I know are well aware of. I can be the quiet wallflower. And by the end of the night, I'm usually the guy that you're taking out of the bar in a headlock screaming, let it die.
So how do you protect your voice? I know, like, I recently interviewed this, like, vocal coach who specializes in coaching people who do, like, hardcore and metal vocals. So have you ever gotten any coaching like that just to learn how to protect your voice?
No, but if this is the same person that you're talking about, it was a woman, and I can't remember her name, but she made like an instructional DVD.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, and my mother bought me that DVD for Christmas.
That's funny.
I never watched it. I probably should. One of these days, I'll get around to it.
So what I want to do is play the beginning and the end of Let It Die so we hear both sides of you. Do you want to say anything about the song before we hear it or about your performance?
Well, most of the songs that we write begin with an acoustic guitar. A lot of these ideas just begin with me at home watching Top Chef playing an acoustic guitar in my lap, and I come up with an idea and I think, oh, that's kind of cool, and I'll put it on my little tape recorder next to the couch. And so sometimes if it's a really interesting riff or if it's a really beautiful melody, I'll keep it and then bring it to the band and say, hey, let's try to make this into a song, and the four of us arrange it. And with this record, we took a lot of time and put a lot of effort into making every song as dramatic as possible. So if it were going to be a mellow intro, then it really had to be whisper, soft spoken. And if it were going to be a big rock crescendo, there's going to be 30 guitars tracked in there, just flying left and right, and amps turned to 11. You know, and that's kind of what we did for this one.
Okay, this is Let It Die. We'll hear the beginning and the end. This is the Foo Fighters.
A heart of gold, but it lost its pride. Bloodshot eyes. I've seen your face in another light. Why'd you have to go and let it die? Why'd you have to go and let it die? Why'd you have to go?
That's the Foo Fighters, the beginning and end of Let It Die from their new CD, Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. My guest, Dave Grohl, is the leader of the band. He's a drummer, guitarist, songwriter, and singer, wears a lot of hats in the band. Which hats are you wearing on that track?
That song, I'm just singing and playing guitar. I haven't played drums on one of our records for a really long time.
Why not?
Well, because we have a phenomenal drummer, Taylor Hawkins. He's a decathlete. He's amazing. The guys, I'm really lucky to have found him to be in my band, and he's been with us for, I guess, maybe 11 years, 12 years, maybe. That's, as a band, we're like a family, you know, and everybody serves their purpose, and everybody holds down their corner of what we do, and you know, Taylor is not only my best friend in the world, but an incredible drummer. And so the relationship that we have as two drummers is interesting. It's not like any other relationship I have in my life. We're close personally, but then we're also connected by this love and understanding of rhythm and drums. So when we're writing songs, you know, I might request something, or I might try to steer him in a direction, but for the most part, the guy, he doesn't need me to tell him what to do, because he's an incredible drummer. So,
do you miss playing drums?
I do, until I sit down and I do it for 4 minutes, and then I remember why I stopped.
Which is why?
it's really tiring. it can be really tiring. When I was That's kind of a joke. When I was young, I was tireless. I could play for hours and hours and hours on end in all the fast hardcore punk rock bands that I was playing in. And then in Nirvana, I couldn't play hard enough. I felt like those songs were so simple and wide open that I spent most of my time just trying to break the drum set. And and I succeeded. Every now and then I actually would. But, you know, I really miss playing the drums. And I still play the drums on different people's albums. And when we're here in the studio... we have our own studio, so I'll come in here and record stuff by myself. And it really is, I feel more comfortable doing that than anything else. And I'm not the greatest drummer in the world, but I can turn my mind off and do it. And I feel like I'm flying. It's great.
I want to play the most out of character song on your new CD. And it's called Ballad of the Beaconsfield Miners. And there's an incredible story behind the song. And well, let me ask you to tell the story.
Okay. I guess it was probably about 2 years ago that there was a mine collapse in this town called Beaconsfield in Tasmania. There were three miners that were trapped about a kilometer underground. One of them unfortunately died, but two survived. And it took a few days, but finally the rescuers tunneled down, and I guess they maybe drilled a hole to contact the miners that were trapped, and found that they were alive, and said, "Well, until we can actually pull you out, is there anything that we can get you?" And one of the miners requested an iPod with our last album on it, In Your Honor, and I was so moved. I was really touched because I felt like. I write lyrics on cocktail napkins, and we record these albums in our own studio. And to feel like something that I do could perhaps help someone in a situation like that, which is an unimaginable situation, just to be trapped in a mine for weeks that far underground. And the first thing that they ask for is water and a Foo Fighters record. You know, I was genuinely blown away, and it changed the way I look at what I do, to feel like your music is making a difference in someone's life. Just, you know, it changes everything. So I wrote them a note, and I said, "Hey guys, it's Dave, and I know I'm on the other side of the planet right now, but you're in my thoughts and prayers, and I hope our music is helping you guys out, and when you get out, there's a couple cold beers and tickets to a Foo Fighters show. Wherever you want to come see us play, just come on and we'll hang out."
So did you get to take them to a Foo Fighters concert?
I did, yeah. That we went down to play at the Sydney Opera House, and I knew that Brant Webb, one of the miners, was coming to the gig. So the night before, I was in my hotel room with my guitar, and I wrote this instrumental, and I thought, you know, I'm going to dedicate this to Brant tomorrow night. So we played the show, and I dedicated the song to him, and it's the same as it is on the album. And afterwards, we went to the hotel bar and we hung out all night and had a couple drinks. And I promised him I'd put it on the record, so I had to.
Well, here's that track. This is "Ballad of the Beaconsfield Miners" from the Foo Fighters' new CD. Ballad of the Beaconsfield Miners from the new Foo Fighters CD, Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace, My guest, Dave Grohl, is the founder of the band, and he is a singer, guitarist, and drummer. Now, you decided to form the Foo Fighters after Kurt Cobain's death. And you had to figure out what your sound was compared to what Nirvana's sound was. You'd had such great success with Nirvana. And apparently all along you'd been writing songs that you thought of as your songs and not Nirvana songs. Did that help guide you in terms of trying to figure out what your band was going to be compared to Nirvana?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, even before I was in Nirvana, I was recording music by myself in my friend's basement studio, and it was always just an experiment, you know. I didn't aspire to be the lead singer of a arena rock band, you know. I was just doing these little experiments, and it was like my own little secret. I wouldn't play them for many people. I'd record a song and maybe make a cassette for my sister, maybe a cassette for my friend Jimmy or my mother, and it was just another outlet for me. It was a way for me to, you know, just play more music, and I was perfectly happy in Nirvana being the drummer. It was when you're in a band with someone like Kurt, who was a really gifted songwriter. I mean, his songs were really simple and direct and almost like nursery rhymes, you know, but with distortion pedals and cymbals washing all over them. So it was great being the drummer of that band. I loved it. But I would come home from those tours and go down into my basement and record music on my own. You know, there's a famous old joke. What was the last thing that the drummer said before he was kicked out of the band? And the punchline is, hey guys, I got a couple songs I think we should record. So there's some truth to that, you know? And, you know, when you're in a band and everything's working so well, the last thing you want to do is pollute that process, you know? And honestly, what I was writing and recording, I didn't consider to be anywhere near what Nirvana was doing. I just thought it was this innocent little game that I would play by myself. But after Kurt died, I wasn't sure what to do or where to go, and I stopped playing music for a while, and it was hard to listen to music, any music, because of that association, you know? Like, I always considered music to equal life and celebration, and all of a sudden music equaled death and the loss of a friend. So I've put it away for a while. And then eventually I realized that, you know, music is part of the healing process because it's been such a huge part of my life and my heart for the longest time.
You first got into Nirvana because a friend of yours who was in a band knew one of the musicians in Nirvana, and your band was breaking up, so your friend put in a word for you. And then what? Did you have to, like, do an audition? I know Nirvana had already been through several drummers, even though it was early in their life as a band. But what did you have to do to prove yourself?
Well, we set up in this tiny little rehearsal space the size of a New York kitchen, and plugged in and played 10 songs and looked at each other and thought, okay, yeah, that'll work. Okay, there wasn't any grand audition. It was pretty quick, and we didn't there was this incredible lack of communication in the band, in good ways and bad ways. When we'd have an amazing show, we wouldn't walk off stage and pat each other on the back and say, that was great. We're a great band. We would never talk about the music. Even when we were writing songs, there wasn't a lot of discussion about arrangement or dynamic. It was all really, really natural. We'd just jam and songs would happen. And the quiet, loud dynamic that developed was a result of that. Like, the build-ups into a chorus, those build-ups were used instead of words, you know, instead of saying, I think after four bars, we should kick into the chorus. That wouldn't happen. I would just start a drum roll and everyone would know. So it was like we had this ESP with each other.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dave Grohl, the founder, lead singer, and songwriter of the band Foo Fighters. They have a new CD called Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. Grohl started the band after the 1994 suicide of Kurt Cobain. Grohl played drums in Nirvana from 1990 until Cobain's death. This is Nirvana's recording, Heart-Shaped Box. That's Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box. Let's get back to our interview with Dave Grohl. I'd like to play Smells Like Teen Spirit, which is probably like the most popular song that Nirvana recorded, and this is from the album Nevermind. Would you talk about your drumming on this track before we hear it? Very powerful.
Thank you. When we wrote this song, we were rehearsing in a barn behind someone's house in Tacoma, Washington. And we would play it. We'd rehearse about 5 hours a day, maybe about 5 days a week, for months and months and months, and just tightening up the band and coming up with new ideas and new songs. And Smells Like Teen Spirit was one of those. The Kurt came in with this guitar idea, and I think he'd worked out a melody. And like I said, it was one of those songs that we just started jamming on, and it was all about the release and the energy of just getting away from the world, hiding out in this little barn and jamming. And this is what happened.
You know, I want to say earlier you compared some of Kurt Cobain's songs to like nursery rhymes. I see some of them as almost like chants. Like this, for instance, has a chant quality to it. And but you're doing this kind of real power drumming behind it, and it's such an interesting contrast.
Well, to me the sound of the band was about the melody and the dissonance. Or the melody and the energy of what we were doing, having amplifiers screaming, blaring feedback, just tear your face off guitar sounds, with a simple melody that was pretty. I thought that was such a beautiful contrast, you know. And like I said, I felt like I couldn't hit the drums hard enough. So I felt like I was this steamroller that was just sort of pushing these beautiful songs, you know. A lot of them almost seem playful in their melody or in their structure. And to me, I felt like an army behind it. It was a cool place to be.
Okay, here's Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit. My guest, Dave Grohl on drums. recorded in 1991 with my guest, Dave Grohl, on drums. And Grohl is also the founder of the Foo Fighters. The Foo Fighters have a new CD, which is called Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. That song and the album that it was on, Nevermind, was a huge success for Nirvana. Were you comfortable with that level of commercial success, having lived in like the, you know, like alternative rock or rock underground or punk underground, whatever you want to call it, for so long? To have that kind of visibility and commercial success afterwards, did it seem like a comfortable place?
It did and it didn't. I mean, I don't think that Chris or Kurt, or I don't think that any of us expected that was going to happen. And, you know, honestly, when I found out that we had a gold record, when we had sold 500,000 copies, my first thought was that, you know, I could get my own apartment. And I was so excited that I didn't have to crash on someone's couch anymore. You know, I just thought, oh my God, I can buy a car. I can have an apartment. These are things that I never had, you know? And I was really excited that I could actually support myself doing what I love to do. So it was a pretty good feeling at first, and then it just went haywire and everything was completely out of control and you felt like you were being sucked up in a tornado. And there were days where you just wanted to escape. But ultimately, personally, I didn't think of it as a bad thing, because, you know, we didn't change the band to make that happen. You know, a lot of people change what they do in order to make that sort of thing happen. And we just kind of had a party and everybody came, you know, and to me, I was really proud of that.
Yeah. You said, you know, after Nevermind, you could actually get your own apartment. You had lived for a while with Kurt Cobain. How long did you live together in the same apartment?
I think it was maybe 8 months or 9 months or something like that. We lived in a house that was split into three apartments, and ours was around the back of the house, and it was a mess. I mean, it was disgusting. You people shouldn't live that way.
What was so disgusting about it? Would you describe it?
I mean, the floor was just there was this awful kind of beige Berber carpet that was just littered with cigarette butts and corn dog sticks, and the window was broken and never repaired. So on a winter night, the living room would be about, I don't know, 40 degrees. And that was my room. So I slept on a couch in a sleeping bag, and I'm 6 feet tall and the couch is probably 4.5 feet long. And so my feet are hanging over the edge, and in the corner, Kurt used to, he had a thing for turtles. He loved turtles. And so he had made this makeshift turtle aquarium or whatever out of, I think there were storm windows that he had put up or something like that. And these poor turtles all night long just were trying to escape, you know? And so they would just butt their heads against the glass all night long. And the thing, it just stank. And I mean, it was really, really bad. It was horrible. So you can imagine my first check for $700. I thought, I made it. I'm getting out of here. I've made it. I need to go get my own place. Yeah, it was pretty gross.
Kurt Cobain had a heroin habit, and when you became aware of his addiction and realized what a problem it was for his health, but also for the band, did you feel in a difficult position about whether to try to intervene at all, whether that would be of any use?
Absolutely. I think, well, you have to remember that I didn't know these two guys before I joined the band, you know. I flew up there, and the day they picked me up from the airport was the day that I met the two of them. So it wasn't long before, you know, we realized that there was a problem. And Chris Novoselic, who who is the bass player of Nirvana, he grew up with Kurt, and that's they started the band together when they were kids. And, you know, as best friends, I think that Chris had that conversation with Kurt at some point. And I remember having a brief conversation about it with Kurt, and Kurt saying, like, yeah, no, that's, I'm not going to do that. That's gross. I don't, that's, it's a filthy habit, and don't worry, I'm not going to do that sort of thing again. I think someone who becomes addicted to something like heroin can be really hard to reach, because at the end of the day, the only person that's going to pull them out of something like that is themselves. And, yeah.
Getting back to the music and to the band's life on stage, Kurt Cobain would sometimes like dive onto your drum kit.
Yeah.
Would you like describe what the experience was like on your end he would do that?
The first few times it happened, I imagined it being this cathartic experience. Like, wow, man, he's so into the music. He's sacrificing his body for this song, and he's diving into a pile of drums, which can only be the most painful thing you've ever done in your life. And then after a year or so, I heard Chris Novoselic telling a story about how Kurt used to do that because when he felt like the drummer wasn't playing well, he would just dive into the drum set. So my whole perspective kind of changed a little bit. I'm like, oh, wait. But I thought that it was, oh, really? Oh. So, yeah.
So, well, like, how close would he come to knocking you off your chair when he dived into the drums?
I saw him coming. And if I saw him, it was, you know, it's like standing in front of a bull or something. You see that thing running at you and you run away. So I did my best to avoid any.
Would you abandon your chair?
Oh, yeah. What am I going to keep playing? No. I mean, I don't want to get run over by the guy. So I'd usually kind of just step out for a minute and let him do his thing.
And would it ruin your drums? Did your drums ever get hurt?
Oh, man, my drums. The tour that we did for that album, Nevermind, the American tour went from, I think, September of 91 to Halloween of 91. And we started the tour playing these really small venues because they were the type of place Nirvana would usually play. And the album came out and the Smells Like Teen Spirit video went on MTV, and we'd show up to a place that would normally hold about 110 people, and there'd be 500 people outside. I think, oh my God, that's a lot of, how are they going to squeeze all those people in? And that was my gauge of what was happening to the band and how popular the band was getting, is every time we'd pull up to a club, there'd be twice as many people as there should be at the club, but lying around the block, people trying to get in. And we had to start upgrading the venues to fit, you know, the audience, to accommodate all the people that wanted to see the band. But on that tour, we were still in a van. There were six or seven of us in a van with the trailer pulled behind. And Kurt would chop at my drums with his guitar. And so a lot of shows would just end with total destruction. And guitars can be pieced back together. It can all be glued back together. You know, you can smash a guitar and play it the next night. It might not sound any good, but that's beside the point. You know, you just want to smash it. So by the time we get to Chicago, my drum set had holes in it. I mean, there were holes in the toms, and my kick drum was completely destroyed. It was splintered. And I kept saying to our tour manager, hey, Monty, do you think maybe I could get a new drum set? Because these sound like crap, man. I mean, they have holes in them. And he'd say, oh, just hold. Can you hold off for another week? Because, you know, we're a little low on money. And I'd say, yeah, man, I could hold off for another month. But honestly, dude, these things sound like crap. He said, just hold off. So I'd ask a couple days later, Monty, I'm telling you, I really need to get another drum set. This thing is falling apart. And he said, well, just hold off one more week. And as we were pulling into Chicago to play our show, we had the radio on in the van, and there was a commercial for the Drum Center, half off everything, 50% off at the Drum Center. And I thought, okay, you know what? Tonight, I'm going to destroy my drum set beyond repair so that I can go to the Drum Center and get a drum set for half off. So that night, I kind of whispered in Kurt's ear before the show. I said, hey, man, let's really do a number on the drums tonight so I can get a new set tomorrow. He goes, okay. So at the end of the gig, we actually told the audience, hey, you guys can, you know, leave if you want, but we're going to splinter this drum set. We're going to turn it into firewood. So, and the audience, 1,200 people, sat and watched us completely destroy. No music. It was just the sound of two guys destroying drums on stage. And I walked off stage really proud of myself. And the next day was Sunday, and the Drum Center was closed. So I had to use the opening band set.
Oh, there must have been nothing left to play.
Nah, there wasn't anything left. It was a good time, though.
I want to play another track, and this is a song that you wrote when you were in Nirvana. But you never gave the song to Nirvana to play. You just recorded it yourself. It's Friend of a Friend. It's a song about Kurt Cobain. Would you talk about the song before we hear it?
Well, when I moved up there to play with those guys, you know, it was a really weird time for me because I grew up in Springfield, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., and I have an amazing family, a great mother and father, a great sister, good friends that I've known since I was 5 or 6 years old, and I never imagined moving away from there. I just sort of thought I'd always be there. I worked at a furniture warehouse. It was good, you know, life was good. And ending up in Seattle, somewhere I'd only been once in my life and enjoyed, I liked it a lot, but I was, you know, I didn't know anybody and I didn't have anything. And I was in a band with these two strangers and they were great people, but you know, I missed home. And, there was an acoustic guitar in the room and I just started writing songs at night when Kurt would go to sleep. I'd sit on the couch and write these quiet acoustic songs. And this song, Friend of a Friend, I wrote about the two people that I just joined the band with, you know?
There's a line, he needs a quiet room with a lock to keep him in. What does that refer to?
Well, every night before going to sleep, Kurt would go into his room and close the door and write in his journal. He wrote every night and I think a lot of his ideas, lyrically, and maybe musically, came from that. But he was really prolific, and I think that time that he had to himself every night was entirely his own. And you know, he would write for hours every night.
Well, let's hear "Friend of a Friend," and this is Dave Grohl's song. He's singing it, and here it is.
It's a quiet room with a lock to keep him in. It's just a quiet room and he's there. He plays an old guitar with a corn found by the phone. It was his friend's guitar that he played.
That's Dave Grohl singing a song he wrote for Kurt Cobain, or about Kurt Cobain, I should say. When they were living together in the same apartment. And Dave Grohl was the drummer in Nirvana and has subsequently been the founder and leader of the Foo Fighters. And the Foo Fighters have a new CD, which is called Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Grohl. He played drums in Nirvana from 1990 until Kurt Cobain's suicide in 1994. After Nirvana dissolved, Grohl started the band Foo Fighters. They have a new CD called Echoes, Silence, Patience, and Grace. You have a 17-month-old daughter now. Do you sing lullabies to her? And what, if so, like what kind of music do you sing or play for her?
Right now, we have jam sessions sometimes where she'll get a pair of drumsticks and sit down in front of a snare drum and just beat out some noisy rhythm, and I'll play guitar. And what I like to do is I like to make up songs with words that she knows so that she'll sing along. So I'll sing a song called House, and I basically just repeat the word house over the verse and the chorus until she starts trying to sing along with me. And then I'll sing a song about horses where the chorus is just nay, 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 you know? And so, yeah, I mean, we haven't done any television. We haven't done any Barney or Wiggles or any of the kids stuff. Like she likes music, and she actually has good taste in music. If I have the radio on, she'll stand still for the songs that I hate instinctually, and then a really great Beatles song or Creedence Clearwater Revival song will come on, and she'll start dancing. And I'll think, wow, you already have good taste in music. How did that happen?
Well, I'd like to end with the final track from the new Foo Fighters CD, which is called Home. And it's a beautiful song. And again, I'll ask you to introduce it for us, to tell us about writing it.
Well, I got a piano for my birthday about a year and a half ago, and I'd never played piano before. It always seemed really intimidating to me. As a rock musician that plays guitar and drums, you could imagine that there were just too many too many little buttons on that thing. I didn't know what the white ones did. I didn't know what the black ones did. And I've taught myself how to play all of the instruments that I play. So I got this piano for my birthday, and I sat down, and someone said, you know, all you really need to know is that note right there is middle C. And I thought, oh, okay, well, if that's a C, well, then that's a G. And I started playing and coming up with melodies and just writing these really simple songs. And this is the first song that I wrote on the piano, and I didn't imagine it to be a Foo Fighters song because it's so unlike anything we've ever done. But then we did a demo of it, and I sat down and wrote these lyrics really quickly and listened back, and it kind of gave me the chills because I felt like I'd finally accomplished that thing that I'd been trying to do for 20 years, to write a song like this. And this, I'm more proud of this song than anything I've ever done in my life, because as a musician, you want to be able to tap into that thing or that place inside of you that's entirely real, and to be able to express it so that it makes sense. And I listen to this song, and it sounds like it makes sense, and that's all I've been trying to do.
Well, Dave Grohl, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you very, very much, and good luck with the
Thanks
new
for
CD.
Having me. No, it's been an honor to be on your show. Thank you very much.
It's a real pleasure to have you. And this is the Foo Fighters from their new CD, Echo, Silence, Patience, and Grace. This is Home.
Wish I were with you, but I couldn't stay.